This is an interesting study. I've really enjoyed this year. I told my wife this year has been a little less pressure for me to get it ready for one reason. I guess it's more a little more familiar material. And, you know, we're not talking about strange places and strange sounding names. We're talking about things that happened in our country and people who some of them are still alive. And that makes all that a little easier. And material is accessible. So it's been interesting. And I also learned if I start on Monday and work quite a bit on Monday, the pressure's off on Wednesday. It took me a while to figure that out. But one reason I haven't done this, so am I going to study 3 days a week to get ready for Wednesday night? Well, maybe I should. So for this next year, which will be, by the way, starting September, that's going to be a 9/11 event. Well, Schleiermacher is on the board over there, you see. So I draw this stuff up over there because I'm kind of bored waiting for you to get here. So I don't know if that means a lot, but except that on the left-hand side, you basically have the descent. You start out with correct orthodoxy, and you go to liberalism or modernism, and you go to neo-orthodoxy, and you go to nothingness. And that's kind of where we are right now, nothingness. And then on the right side over here is our lesson today, a very difficult concept to get across, and I guess that's why it's so popular. But we have a kind of a three-corner religion. We have somehow kingdom thinking, and we have ethics that are in the kingdom, morality that's in the kingdom. It's kingdom living, we call it. It's a kingdom now and here. And then we also have somewhere thrown in for good measure the gospel. And the gospel sometimes is the gospel of the kingdom. And we see that when we get down to our next fall talk about a lad and his gospel of the kingdom, which I did a whole paper on, which I can hardly wait to teach. So he equates the gospel with the kingdom, which is, how in the world did you do that? But in this system, you do. And then we have this word that Henry uses, Carl H. F. Henry uses, I think I counted with my computer, counted like over 100 times. He used some kind of extract from the word redemption. So everything's redemptive. You know, it's a redemptive life. It's a redemptive culture. It's redemptive weather. It's redemptive traffic. So this word gets thrown around and really is undefined, but we all know what it means. And since we don't know what it means, we use it anyway. So anyway, that's what this whole thing is, and we're going to try to move through that. Not try, we will move it today, and we will lock the doors. We are not going to leave because I can't do this again next week, so we're done. We're done. So liberalism has some relationship to this triangle, and covenantal borrows from liberalism way too much in I won't say reform, but it's really covenantalism, borrows from liberalism, and so they are somewhat bedfellows in certain cases. So what we have to do next year, we have to do Fuller Seminary. We have the Battle of Inerrancy, which we lived through even our church age. We want to talk about Billy Graham. So a lot of people talk about Billy Graham. Where does he fit? And who is Billy Graham, frankly? And then we have George Elton Ladd. We have Carnell, another guys, two guys from Fuller. And we're going to talk about neo-orthodoxy and Daniel Fuller and his influence in Fuller and his mother's relationship with his son and the father who, you know, had to die before they could change the school. You know, intrigue like that. And then we find that all the church growth movement comes out of Fuller as well. We have Rick Warren, Bill Hybels, Robert Jewler. They all come from the Southern California thing. So we have a lot of stuff to do. It'll probably take us all year to get done, so. Which I kind of like because I don't have to figure something else to do. All right. Did I say everything I was going to say? I did want to thank you for coming. I mean, I really appreciate it. Wouldn't be the same without you. It just wouldn't be the same because I have taught the class without you being here when I did get my machine turned on or something and then have to come back the next day and do this with nobody here. It's not a lot of fun. So I worked real hard to make sure everything's working. And next time we come back, we'll have two screens up here. Won't we, Kevin? Promise me, Kevin. Okay. Kevin? All right. All right, he's been publicly acclaimed. He's going to do it. So I had hope upon hopes that we could do it before we quit, but not the case. All right. Now, there I took 5 minutes off my schedule. Remember, this is a two-part series on apologetics, although I'm not going to talk much about apologetics today, but I want you to know that this is still in the broad subject, apologetics. How do you convince somebody of something? All right. So I won't redo last week's lesson. But 2 weeks ago, we finished our study on the backgrounds of the neo-evangelical phenomenon. That word didn't get used really officially until 1957, so we're a little ahead of our time. We have the personalities of Charles Fuller, Harold Ockenguy, and Carl F.H. Henry. The two H's go together. And the National Association of Evangelical Organization is for the, and we didn't spend much time on the NAE, but it's there. It was really the beginning of this whole thing. In that study, it became apparent that a large, influential, underlying mindset needed further investigation, broadly speaking, apologetics. The neo-evangelicals were fearful that the fundamentalists were going to lose the battle to the modernists in the post-World War II America. They were going to lose America, and we have on the top here, winning America was the objective of the neo-evangelicals, like as if they hadn't won it yet, but anyway. So the fundamentalists, which will turn into neo-evangelicals, but at this point they're still fundamentalists, were highly critical of their own movement. Carl F.H. Henry expressed this in his highly influential book, known as The Uneasy Conscience, and the rest of the title is of modern fundamentalism. So I'm just going to use the word uneasy conscience. He published in 1947. That means he probably was working on it in 1946 already up there in Boston, Massachusetts, and is highly influential because it still is in print, and you can even get it in Kindle. So a little bit about Henry, what he is going to say. And we're going to do some quotes from him today, and I hope it works for you. And I'll try to keep you informed of what we're doing. I have his name up front so that we don't get mixed up who's saying what. So Henry says in his book, the picture is clear when one brings into focus. By the way, his syntax is supposed to be so lofty. It's hard to read. And he uses words in places where you don't expect words to be used. So it really reads strange. So I figured that's what an intellectual does. It makes something simple seem complex. And if you're good at that, you're an intellectual. So he must be really good at that. So watch as we read. I'll try to read carefully. The picture is clear when one brings into focus such admitted social evils as, these are the social evils, as aggressive warfare, racial hatred, intolerance, and tolerance, the liquor traffic, the exploitation of labor or management, whichever it may be, the social reform movements dedicated to the elimination of such evils do not have the active, let alone vigorous, cooperation of large segments of evangelical Christianity. Isn't that an awkward way of saying it? And there's no one participating in these things, against these things, if they're in evangelical Christianity. Large segments are ignoring all these problems. So the correction was focused on three factors that needed to be changed so that the fundamentalists could be effective. And they are, I do want you to remember these, if you can, kind of think about it. The inclusiveness, that we're inclusive of all Christianity. We're not often aside by ourselves. To develop a more inclusive idea of Christianity than that of the stringent separatists who are intransigent. That was one we did last week. Second one we did last week. Develop scholars who can contribute to the body of evangelical Christian knowledge at a level that even those rejecting fundamentalism will have to acknowledge. Quite a lofty goal. And then today's, develop a social consciousness that will lead to actions that address the growing social needs. Now remember, we're talking 1946 when there were no social needs. I mean, compared to today. And I think we have spent all these years fixing the social problems, and I'll show you at the end of our lesson, we're not getting anywhere. We're not getting anywhere. In fact, we're going backwards. So I give you this little picture. I made it kind of like a gate or panels in a gate. So we have, these are the obstacles to winning America, which is across the bridge, down the road, our objective. We have the issue of separation. We have the issue of too much separation, not enough scholarship, and not nearly enough social conscience. Those are the three objectives or obstacles that are perceived by the neo-evangelicals. So last week we couched the argument to win America in apologetic terms, the nature and art of persuasion. If you wonder what apologetic means, the nature and art of persuasion. The apologetics used may or may not be effective. You know, that doesn't make it non-apologetic. A second factor in persuasion is the fallen man question or issue. That is, what kind of stimulus does a fallen man respond to? Can a good apologetic fail to convince? And the answer is yes. Can even a bad apologetic be convincing? And the answer could be yes. So all of a sudden, apologetics really don't fit in here very well as a convincing tool. But we use it. The point is that neither are ultimate factors. The reality is that convincing comes from God and not from man. And that is where our Calvinism comes in. Last week we found out that Henry and Ockenghay were likely Calvinists, and I'm guessing a little bit here, trained in the use of apologetics because one of their group, Clark, was an apologetic teacher. So trained in the use of apologetics, but their position seemed to collapse in the approach of winning America. So they sort of forgot their Calvinism, they sort of forgot their approach to apologetics, and they went Arminian in trying to win America. Anything goes, so it's all up to us. It appears that man can be convinced by external factors if presented in the right fashion, they would say. Their apologetics, were either offensive or defensive, depend on the arguments and evidences and do not take into account, I don't think they took into account, man's absolute fallenness, which you have to always do. They are practicing a complete or practical Arminianism, even though they would not identify with that, I think. So believing that it all depends on their, that is man's approach, the neo-fundamentalists, or the neo-evangelicals as they will be called, propose to make the necessary adjustments to right the listing ship. Last week we dealt with the correction. One, the hardline separation being practiced. Rather, we should dialogue and convince the opposition as friends, not as enemies. Stop calling them bad names, yelling across the theological oceans. Speak to them softly and they will listen. And to some extent, we say, well, that makes some sense. Secondly, we consider the lack of scholarship being produced by the fundamentalists. A high-level scholarly work will convince the neutral modernist. It will convince the neutral modernist, that's not true, but you know they all have to go approach it that way, the neutral modernist of the errors, and they will be thanked for it. The motivation to produce these literary works was reasonable because the European influence on Christianity was having a devastating effect on the Americans. Their errors must be convincingly corrected, lest America will be lost forever. So we continue to the last apologetic, the last obstacle for consideration, that which will convince those at risk so that winning America can be accomplished. And that criticism is to develop a social conscience that will deal with the overwhelming social needs of the culture. Now we're back in 1946, post-World War II. When the liberals see our social concern and the solutions, now get this. This is a quote, by the way. When they see our social concerns and the solutions our scholars will work out, then America will turn from the destruction of modernism. Now, maybe you just slide over that if you're not thinking what he's saying. We don't know how this is supposed to be worked out, but our scholars will work it out. Tremendous dependency on the scholarship, which will come out more as we go along. So last of these three is what we're looking at. The charges of the uneasy conscience, blah, blah, blah. So some representative comments from his book, all written very differently. So the first one started out really, really good. If you just should have quit here. Okay, the enemy is down. Liberalism has died. That's over there. Liberalism has died. Where are we now? We're on number two. Remove supernaturalism. Supernaturalism has not worked out, which leaves the moralism. Moralism hasn't worked out, so we're really left with nothing. So liberalism is dead. So liberalism can't do what it said it's going to do. Now it's time to strike with the truth, right? No, now's the time to join the liberals. That's how it works out. So a good start, Henry. I mean, not Henry, but Henry says. The modernist embarrassment is serious indeed. This is Henry talking. The shallow insistence on inevitable world progress and man's essential goodness have been violently declared false. Not only sound Bible exegesis, but the world events from 1914, 1946 includes World War I and World War II, indict optimistic liberalism, which another word for that is, I got it up there, postmillennialism. Postmillennialism died with the Second World War. So these social ills continue, Henry points out, as the liberals fail, they supposedly make a charge against the successful fundamentalists. Now, this drives me nuts, because Henry is making this charge as if the liberals are making it. I don't think the liberals are really talking here, but Henry is speaking for the liberals. Okay, Henry points out that the liberals fail. They supposedly make a charge against the successful fundamentalists that they have no social program calling for a practical attack on acknowledged world evils. Henry says that liberals are saying that. Now, if Henry is right, and not just projecting his own uneasy conscience, why would it matter what the liberals say after they have failed? Why would we care what they would say? You know, we're going to go back to their failed policies? They have no moral right to lecture the fundamentalists, frankly. But we will accept the charge for argument's sake and go on to answer the modernists. So I don't know why he brings this up, like as if the liberals have an upper hand here because they have had the moral consciousness. But moral consciousness failed. He just admitted it. But we got to go back to the moral consciousness. So social ills continue. Henry points out that the fundamentalists lack any social passion, he says. On this evaluation, fundamentalism is the modern priest and Levite passing by suffering humanity. Can you imagine the Samaritan on the road? Oh, sorry, boy. I'm moving on. That's how it looks to them. Now, I will admit my commenting on Henry's arguments, which are proofs that the liberal and reformed ideas of moralism lives unshakably in his mind. See, he's been affected by these things. Covenantalism is infected by liberalism. And he's not really a covenantalist, but he's leaning that way. He's actually a historic premillennial. I will admit that my comment on Henry's arguments, which are proofs that the liberal and reformed ideas of moralism lives unshakably in his mind, because he too is confused about the kingdom, which he equates nearly with the gospel, as does his co-teacher at Fuller, George Elton Ladd. And that's why I put this thing in a circle. I don't know when we're moving from one to the other. This is all melted together. I don't know when he's moving from one to the other, because they're all melted together. Social ills continue, Henry points out. The picture is clear when one brings into focus such admitted social evils as, now I guess these are generally admitted social evils, as aggressive warfare, racial hatred and intolerance, and liquor traffic and exploitation of labor or management, whichever it may be. We've kind of had something like that already, just repeated it. So social ills continue. In fact, fundamentalist churches increasingly have repudiated the very movements whose most energetic efforts have gone into the attack of such social ills. The study of fundamentalists' avoidance of and bitter criticism of the World Council of Churches, the Federal Council of Churches of Christ in America, is a pertinent example. In other words, the fundamentalists never joined those groups. And we should have joined those groups because that's an example that we're not cooperating with them. Now, I might note here that the reason they didn't join them because they were void of the gospel. They're void of the gospel. We don't join groups like that. So still Henry. The situation is even darker, an even darker side. The great majority of fundamentalist clergymen during the last generation of the world's disintegration. What do you say today? The world's disintegration became increasingly less vocal about social ills. It was unusual to find a conservative preacher occupied at length with the world's ills. And I might add here, all the while the liberals were preaching 100% moralism, and it failed, and I ask again, why join them now? So in a question and answer dialogue with fundamentalist preachers, it was asked about their preaching, if they had preached a sermon concerning not merely an incident or illustrative reference, but directly mainly against such evils and proposing the framework in which you could think a solution is possible. Have anybody preached like that from the fundamentalists? Apparently there was a group that got together, like a conference probably. And he said, not a single hand was raised in response. Now this situation is not characteristic, only of one particular denominational national group of fundamentalists, rather a predominant trait in most fundamentalist preaching is this reluctance to come to grips with the social evils. Therefore, there are fundamentalist groups in Middle East which have not lost a keen world reference, especially those alert to their reformational linkage in John Calvin. See, he ties it back to the covenant people. They are socially sensitive. I want to be like them. We should be like them. So liberalism and reformational lineage both reach a moralism. Both do. Both are failing to change America. Again, I ask, why should the fundamentalists rush onto a sinking ship? That's not a hard question. Well, their reformed interest in ethics is demanded rather than precluded by their doctrinal fervor. Holding fast to the ideology of supernaturalism. Okay, when the word supernaturalism comes up, it's a good thing because we believe in supernaturalism. God intervenes in history. That's supernaturalism. So he would agree that the Reformed people, covenant people, believe in supernaturalism. But they also were interested in the social aspect, so that's why he's saying this. I'll do this again. In Reformed interest in ethics, their Reformed interest in ethics is demanded by their theology, since they are the New Israel, rather than kept out by their doctrinal fervor. Holding fast to an ideology of supernaturalism, these groups have sometimes been tempted to disassociate themselves with the fundamentalist camp because of the widespread notion that indifference to world evils is essential to fundamentalism. In other words, fundamentalism is excluded in the interest in social evils, and the Reformed people sort of want to leave the group. They want to leave the room. So fundamentalist church exhibit an anti-ecumenical spirit of independent isolationism, an uncritically held set of theological formulas. This is dispensationalist, uncritically held set of theological formulas. Now, what do you call TULIP? Is that not a uncritically held theological formula? Anyway, one calls the other one the same thing, I guess. An overly emotional type of revivalism. I don't know where that comes from exactly. There's also the tendency to replace great church music by barn dance variety of semi-religious choruses. Some churches have almost become spiritualized jukeboxes. I had to throw that in there. I mean, music is always an issue. The sinfulness of man and the exceeding sinfulness of sin and that God alone can save man from his disaster are insistences that are heard with commonplace frequency only within the evangelical churches, not heard in those liberal churches. But the sin against fundamentalism has invaded almost exclusively was individual sin rather than social sin. And I say, what in the world is social sin? Does the Bible ever define it? It's always defined in your mind, like, I don't know what pornography is, but I'll know it when I see it. You know, it doesn't have a definition. Depends on whether you're looking at art or you're looking at whatever. So Henry's example, the bitter opposition to the use of intoxicating beverage is, in a localized sense, an attack upon the liquor traffic. Even though it does nothing to curb the menace, the trafficking itself, and concentrates on schooling the believer to circumvent it. Now, this is an upside-down argument, it seems to me like, but I'll do what I said here. Now, I think he's pro-drinking. All right, not against drinking, but he's against trafficking of alcohol, okay? So my thought is, well, if you don't drink, there won't be any traffic, right? Does that kind of go together? It's kind of like the same argument we're going to have with marijuana today, I think. You know, no one uses marijuana, there's no market. All right. So, but we're going to attack the market, not the user. Okay. So he's attacking the user for teaching you shouldn't use it. And when you do that, that has nothing to do with the trafficking. I said, well, let's fix it the way you ought to fix it. All right. In this statement, not an admission that preaching against social is this statement, not an admission that preaching against a social sin does something. I mean, he's saying if you preach against it, it's going to have something to do with the trafficking. But that's not how you want to do this. There is no trafficking when no one drinks. That seems to be logical. Henry's point is that the fundamentalist should be preaching against trafficking, not against drinking. Again, why should not preaching against drinking also stop trafficking? So much immoral act is, so which immoral act is preached against? I did not know that drinking was an issue back in those days. Back to Henry. It remains a question whether one can be perpetually indifferent to the problems of social justice and international. We've expanded now. We're not only in our country. Now we're global. Okay. It remains a question whether one can be perpetually indifferent to the problems of social justice and international order and develop a wholesome personal ethics. So the presumption is here, if one does not take up social causes, one becomes immoral himself. I say that's a heavy charge. And I think he believes that. It's immoral not to be against immorality. But here again, it must be conceded that the defection of Christian culture, American culture, from the vital Christianity means that the problem of the home and juvenile delinquency is unconfronted in countless family circles, by the way, outside the church, you know, in the culture, where, outside the church, in the culture, where remedial measures might create a more favorable soil for the preaching of the gospel. Now, that one's probably kind of familiar. You go out there and do something good, and those people out there will be open to the gospel because you've done something good for them. So I'm not sure that taking care of pregnant girls is a good thing. Depends on who you are. You know, some say you're really a bad person because you're whatever. By such argument, even those who have disagreed with a supernatural ideology have sought to enlist evangelicalism in reform programs. So he's saying basically as these programs, are we talking about juvenile delinquency and the evangelicals have been involved in some of these programs, that the modernists have joined them and they've seen some benefit from it, so we need to do some more of that. I mean, he's saying that, I don't know if that exists, but he says apparently it did. Usually that goes against the screen. They don't have anything to do with the fundamentalists ever for no reason. So this modernist mindset, insisting that the evangelical supernaturalism was inherent within it an ideological fault, within this truth, which keeps out any vital social thrust, is one of the most disturbing dividing lines in contemporary thought. The idea that you could have a division in Christianity on this issue of social work or social involvement is beyond thought. It's disturbing. We shouldn't divide over this, you know. The evangelicals should stay together. Well, guess who has to give in, all right? So in the modern mindset, Henry dismisses fundamentalism with a thought that in the expression of the great tradition, by the way, the great tradition, or the big switch, they call it, years ago in the 1800s, was when the fundamentalists quit supporting social involvement and left the liberals with it. That's called the Great Tradition. And when they switched over, they lost that tradition. So the Great Tradition, historical social concerns, the humanitarianism has evaporated from Christianity. And I agree with that. That's exactly what happened. Remember Schleiermacher, we'll go back over here. Schleiermacher took out the supernatural and left moralism. What's the next one down? Remove supernatural, leaves moralism. Am I reading? And which is also called humanitarianism. Fundamentalists are right to reject moralism, but for the moralist, there's nothing left for Christianity if moralism is rejected, which is the next step down. The post-trib, post-millennialists rejected the moralism because they didn't get the job done. Instead of these great big wars, so they reject the moralism, and that's why it gets nothing. It's vacant. So I'll do this again. Remember, Schleiermacher took out the supernatural and left moralism, in other words, humanitarianism. Fundamentalists are right to reject moralism, but for the modernists, there's nothing left for Christianity if moralism is rejected. Fundamentalists kept it supernatural and rejected the usurping spirit of moralism. Where is true Christianity? Well, it's where it's not immoralist, it's supernatural. That's the true Christianity, which they rejected. So these quotes give us a sample of the social arguments Henry leaves with us, and they needed correction. It leaves me somewhat in a state of shock over the arrogance or ignorance of history and the naivete of Carl Henry, a trained theologian. But of course, there's a reason for his naivety. If Henry misleads the Holy Book, he will make grave mistakes. His influences from Reformed and liberal ideas are the same. Those influences show how he lost his happy conscience and now has an uneasy conscience. So Henry misunderstood, and he had help from the church fathers, particularly Augustine, who he reveres, and the historic tradition, but he misses the real history, the kingdom that Jesus came to establish. Henry misunderstood the kingdom that Jesus came to establish. If the kingdom is correctly understood, the problems that Henry raises, underscored with a solid Calvinistic apologetics, will straighten out with his listening theology and save him from sinking. Just a couple of things: get the kingdom right, and think about your Calvinistic influence here. God's in charge, not man. So, go back a little bit history. This should be old for you. I hope this is old for you. The kingdom was spiritualized by Augustine, 410 AD, something like that. When he recast it in a spiritualized form of the great kingdom promised Abraham and David, Augustine made the kingdom a Gentile kind of churchish, kingdomish entity, but never completely defined it. The separation of state and church or God was settled by the Anabaptists in 1525. Most of the rest still live confused on the question of both the kingdom and the church. To this day, most of the Americans, most of the people across the world have this confused as we sit here today. The error has not been corrected at all in Reformed theology, covenant theology. And it appears in a slightly modified form in Henry's, pretty much the same. That is, the kingdom is already here, but not quite yet fully here. This may have a cute sounding ring to it, but it is the death knell to real kingdom church theology, which ends in confused and crippled Christians. Henry, he's equivocating on the physical kingdom a bit, although he is a historic premillennial, believes in an earthly kingdom, but he doesn't believe in a Jewish earthly kingdom. He believes in a Gentile earthly kingdom. He jettisons the Jews. The Jews are not anywhere to be seen. They are gone. Still has a kingdom. Nevertheless, the burden of these articles is not, he says, this is his quote again, nevertheless, the burden of these articles that he's writing is not to press his personal kingdom viewpoint, although he does, but rather to promote an evangelical conviction that nothing is so essential among fundamentalist essentials as a world relevance for the gospel. A world relevance, see, we talk about soft words here, all right? Nothing is so essential among fundamentalist essentials, his point of view, as the world relevance for the gospel. Whatever in our kingdom views undercuts that relevance destroys the essential character of Christianity. So what I'm saying here, like I drew on the board, if I take the kingdom out of this, the gospel is lost. Now, do you believe that? And the kingdom and the gospel are not the same thing. But the kingdom brings relevance to the gospel. And that's where we get all these terms of redemptive word, because somehow the gospel is redemption, and in the kingdom there is redemptive activity. See, it just sort of illusions that sort of like, and then the redemptive activities are reduced to moral things, ethics things. Keep on going. So when covenantal explains it, now this is not how I would show, if I'm going to show about how everything is reduced to a common denominator, I'm just going to show it for this particular purposes. So if covenantalism on the top of the line, this is like math, is Christianity. That which supports Christianity is below the line, like we have a common denominator. But you notice it's not just one thing. You need all three things. Kingdom plus social justice plus the gospel. This is staunch liberalism. The elements that make up Christianity, which are these three things, are essential. You drop one of these out and Christianity falls. Christianity, poof, it's gone. You have to have the kingdom, you have to have social justice, and you have to have the gospel. Now, in your mind, you're trying to make the gospel, but you don't want to do that here because the gospel is just something that's redemptive. There's redemption in the gospel, right? But there's redemption in the justice. There's redemption in the kingdom. So this thread goes through this thing back and forth. And if you're sort of a lazy person, which we all are, so I don't know what he means, but I guess he must be okay and go on. But he's saying something terribly, terribly, terribly different here. So if Christianity is tied together by these three events, and you take one of these three events, you no longer have a Christianity. Liberalism, total liberalism. Now we're having a guy that's not liberal saying this. So he's being affected by it. Now this is the way it is. Christianity at the top, and there's only one thing below it, and that's the gospel. Now you take the gospel out of it, Christianity will fall. That's right. But there's nothing else to be taken out because there's nothing else to support it. All right? So I say the same thing. The elements that make up Christianity, without one element, Christianity disappears. That's true. If I take the gospel out of Christianity, Christianity doesn't exist. But I go back in here. I've got kingdom, kingdom teaching, kingdom relationship, redemption of the kingdom, social justice, redemption that's in social justice, the healing of things, whatever, whatever, even among nations, whatever. We don't go to war, whatever. And we have a lot of social justice around these days, whatever that means, plus the gospel, which now isn't death, burial, resurrection of Christ necessarily, although that's just a redemptive act. Other things are redemptive acts as well. All right. By a guy that should know better. Well, now let's get on to the kingdom thing. Kingdom living, Jesus style. It is supposed, and that's why when you study the Bible, know what part of the Bible you're reading. If you're reading the gospel, it's different than the Old Testament. Not a lot, but a little bit. And you read the gospel, it's different than the book of the Revelation, obviously. So it is supposed that Jesus was into kingdom living. And we'd probably say, well, oh, I guess so. I'm not sure what that means exactly, but let's humor him. And he always stood with the poor. After all, he healed the sick and fed the poor. Did he do that? But did he heal all the sick? Did he feed all the hungry who were far from home on two occasions? I think only two occasions. I said, no, just two occasions, and he only did it once. He didn't chase them home and give them breakfast in the morning. So how does this stretch into kingdom living and the mandate to feed the poor? We don't even know these people are poor. They were following him. The reality is that those who were following Jesus were not necessarily poor. They were caught off guard following him to the end of the day, and they were caught and they were stuck, and he helped them like anybody would with one lunch, when they were far off from home. All right? Now that's stretched into kingdom living. So Henry says, no study of the kingdom of teaching of Jesus is adequate unless it recognizes his implication both that the kingdom is here. That is, that it is not here, that it's here, and that it is not here. This does not imply an ultimate paradox, but rather stresses that the kingdom exists in incomplete realization. And it's time to call in the scholars. Time to call in the scholars, because we don't know where the fine lines are here. Would you help us out a little bit? Because the kingdom is not defined. He admits it. This is his word. The kingdom exists in incomplete realization. So I draw my picture on the right, kingdom already, and you're standing somewhere to the end of the kingdom already, and the kingdom then, the kingdom coming, is the same kingdom. It just, moves to a different place, but it's already here. It's already established. We heard this already, but not yet, progressive dispensational phrase. So with time to look for the scholars. Again, we're still quoting here, Henry. So the task of the Bible student is to discover, let's put in a scholar here, to discover what? In what sense is it here? This is always humorous. In what sense is it to be further realized before the advent of Christ? Number three. In what sense it will be fully realized at the advent of Christ? He admits it's not been defined. Then I ask again, who is going to define this kingdom? Because our life depends on it. So I got my little green guy. Notice that the kingdom is revealed by Jesus Christ, but we have no sense of it. And we're waiting, well, 1,000 years, almost 2,000 years to get a sense of it. And I say, we're still waiting. And I think arguments are getting more heated rather than less. We're not figuring out what the kingdom is. So this is not sophistry. Jesus, he came to begin the kingdom as prophesied. His language is unambiguous and clear. I am the Messiah, the king elect. Don't call him a king until he's crowned, by the way. I know we sing about King Jesus. I know that's an acronym. He's not a king until he's crowned. But see, we borrow from other stuff, and it gets into our system. Don't go talking and criticizing about our music. It's just the way it is. But to understand what we're doing. So, I am the Messiah, the king elect. I will form the kingdom in reality, a touching kingdom, in the land that's been promised. But his own people rejected his messianic claim, right? This is clear. I am withdrawing my offer for the kingdom from this generation, Matthew 24. I will give it later to a generation who received me as Messiah. I could put verses behind all of this. I am not planting any other form of my kingdom in my absence. I will be at the right hand of my Father, by the way, if you need me. Is there anything unclear about this? And so where did he ask that question? Well, when the disciples were on the hill, when Jesus was going to heaven, they said to him, is this the time you're now going to restore the kingdom? And he said to them, is this not yet clear to you guys? You know, he said it a little nicer than that. Only the demons who live in the recesses of the minds of unbelief will distort this. Well, maybe you won't agree with this, but I'm going to stick my neck out, and I think this is the way it is. There's only one divine kingdom of God. Uno. One. Of earth, of heaven, of Christ, of earthly kingdom. One kingdom of David, one kingdom, period. End of story. What else can I say? Now, here's where you might disagree. I don't care. But this is where I think it really is. Any other form of the kingdom, we're talking about where God's involved, not earthly kingdoms. Any other form of the kingdom, if any other kingdom forms involve the divine, are metaphysical in use. Such qualities of a real kingdom only fully exist in the messianic future eternal earthly kingdom as promised. That's why if you come to this point, it is so easy to keep it straight. Whenever there's a kingdom in your mind, and it's not the one on earth, it's the kingdom of God, it is one. And it's not started yet. And it will not start until he's crowned king. And that will not happen until he comes back. So now we maybe talk metaphysically and metaphorically. We may talk about an animal kingdom, but none of us think there really is an animal kingdom, do we? Who's the king of the animal? I know the lion is, but he doesn't really reign, you know. There may be an animal kingdom, there may be a plant's kingdom, but we do know these are metaphors. And sometimes we think of God as the king of the universe, and that's metaphorical. And I have looked the whole Bible through to find any clear statement about that. I cannot find one. So I call it, there may be one, a missed, doubtful use. The use must be a metaphor because not an actual kingdom with a king, territory. And by the way, in order to have a king, you have to have territory and you have to have submissive people. You do not have a kingdom unless you have submissive people. And that, as I can tell, is not on earth yet. So in no way, shape, or form can God have a kingdom right now. And it simplifies your Bible reading because if it talks about the kingdom, it's talking about the kingdom of the messianic rule. So, we have the earth and the people. You have yet to submit a condition for a true kingdom to exist. Now, that's maybe a small point, but I'm doing this just to keep the kingdom straight in your mind because it will help you a lot. Because as soon as you have God have one kingdom, the Lord has his own kingdom, we start mixing these together. All right? I'm saying you don't have to do that. In fact, I spent days digging that out one time, and so I give up. Then it's just reversed to the kingdom of Christ. All right. Otherwise, it's metaphorical. The line of Abraham, Jacob, and David is where the kingdom finds fulfillment. And as I say, clarity on this point will help us. So, we have identified the kingdom. We already covered. Now, we have to also identify the nature of the church. Nature and function of the church. I've did this before, this group, earlier, at the time of Finney. So, some of this may be repeating. If you remember everything I said, I'm going to give you an A. Okay, so the nature of the church must be narrowly defined. Narrowly defined. We can't get loose here. The church is not a change agent in society. The church is a change agent for its membership, those born again and associated with a local assembly, that church. And it's described thus by the arrows. The members come from outside to a gathering place. From outside, the whole world, frankly, to this place, in our case. The arrows are the church members coming together to minister and to be ministered to. The group assembled is at home in the local church, sometimes in a building. I say sometimes in a building. In this case, we meet in a building, but we don't have to meet in a building. This is a local church because it is organized and considered the church. We have elders and we have everything else that goes with that. So we know what we are. So the church visible, assembled, is at rest, is assembled, is instructed, is encouraged, it is singing, it is praying, it is giving, it is sending into office, and it is joyful, and whatever else you want to add to it. That's the church. But by the way, it's here, okay? You're as close as that as there is anything. You're sitting in this place. You came from somewhere else. You came here. You came to church. The church does not travel. It does not demonstrate. It is not political force. It stays home. It stays home. Very important point. You don't, but the church does. The church has a biblical agenda. It is content to feed its own body parts. It preaches the gospel, heals the sick souls who come to it. It is representation of Christ's body on earth. It is visible to the naked eye. I see you there. And then it goes into the world. What? The church? No. You do. You go and see the arrows are reversed. Members go into the world. But I'm the church. No, you're not. You're a member of the church, but you're not the church. So when the church is dismissed, the members go into the world, preach the gospel. No place is off limits. Matthew 28 says that. Member influence is outside by word, deed, and presence, giving the gospel message. They act on their own conscience, which provides for an aggregate good without organization or leadership out there. And by cracky, it even has voting power. Because how you voted, there was power in that. We had an election this week, right? I didn't tell you how to vote. God tells you how to vote. That's fine. But in that, collectively, there's power in that. Without organization. Without anybody telling you what to do. But when the church thinks New Israel, it wants to act as a political force to accomplish a moral good. Then the assembly thinks to show a gathered force. Resources are gathered, organized and aimed at chosen evils to be destroyed. Chosen, we can't do them all. We just pick a few. Even restoring to lethal force sometimes. You look back in church history, it has used lethal force to bring people in line. The Puritans did that. Remember Mary Dyer? But it fails to accomplish any lasting good. No one's noticed that, by the way. So without pressure to leave home. Those who don't understand the church tend to drag the church with its membership block into the public square to compete with other public entities. It is clear that this has not worked for 1,500 years. And I have a book from Nathan Hatch, Noel, and George Marsden, which I used for you guys when I made this up or worked on this. We used it earlier trying to find a reformed identity of the church. And I got a whole book, and the name of the book is The Church in Search of Christian America, which is the book purpose is to find out what does the church do in America? And the answer is stay home. But they're trying to get it to do something out there, and they just can't figure out how to do it. So 50 years later, Mark, Noel, and these guys, Hatch, are still trying to figure out what to do with the church. They should have come to my class. So Henry accused the fundamentalists to be deaf to the social ills of the world and ignoring them. That is insulting to the pastors who stand in their pulpits week after week declaring the full counsel of God, which includes a life of sanctification that speaks to all moral challenges of all people. To claim that the word is only to his congregation is a very ignorant statement. Every person present goes out into the world carrying the message he heard preached inside these walls. Now we've got internet. Why do we provide trained church security during church services? Is it because the world is deaf and can't hear the message? Oh no, they hear it really well. Yes, indeed, they hear very well through our brick walls. The hostile, unregenerate do not like what they hear. Don't tell me they don't hear. So do not for a moment charge the fundamentalists of not preaching to the world a moral message. Not only do they preach what is right, thus moral, but is in that message is the living gospel, since none of us are morally right and need a savior. This message is in the sole possession of the fundamentalists or people like them. The likes of Carl Henry ought not to dissuade any pastor to leave his pulpit to other place where the world can hear him better. He is well heard around the world from his pulpit. You understand that? I mean, that is so powerful. It is so discounted. You got to leave that and do something else. It's, you know, why is it attacked? Because it is so effective. Nor should he drag his congregation into the public square where they become a strange and vulnerable force, confused with other humanistic entities. Keep the church at home and then send the members like bees carrying pollen to the four quarters of the earth. That is God's plan. It would be surprising to us. This would be fun sometime. It would be surprised to us to know just how far out our congregation travels each week. I know some of you will be in New York, some will be in San Francisco, some in Las Vegas, you'll be in Minneapolis, you'll be in Dallas, Texas, and you'll come back at 7 days later, and you'll be back in church. And I ask, where have you guys all been? Wouldn't that be fun to find out where you've all been? You know, you've taken the gospel all those places. Now, if you didn't say anything while you're out there, that's not our problem. That's your problem. You know what I'm saying? So I'm not trying to say, well, they didn't say anything. That doesn't count. They were sent out. And if God didn't provide for them, that's between them. Remember, they go out on their own conscience. But they did go out. They didn't stay here. So wouldn't it be a surprise to know how far out our congregation traveled each week? Ah, that would be fun. Now, let us go back to where we started. In the foreword of Henry's book, written by Harold Akinjay. He said, remember when preaching, this is him writing about himself, preaching, Akinjay. Recently when they're preaching a sermon on the influence of the church in the labor crisis, this is in Boston Park Street Church, Akinjay's message, I evoked a comment from a Christian soldier, said he, I am a political liberal on my knees, though I am a fundamentalist in faith. Why must the church be on the wrong side of every major social issue? And that comment is why we have this lesson. Why must the church be on the wrong side of every major issue, every social issue? Well, Akinjay took this statement as an indictment of fundamentalists. He made moves to get the fundamentalists to move to the other side of the social issues by claiming that they were ignoring social ills. Now, I think I already told you they are not being ignored. So which side, right or left, and kind of made this work out for you. The problem with the fundamentalists is not that they are not involved in social concerns or ignoring them. It is that the fundamentalists were on the wrong side of the social issues formula, according to them. They didn't like the side we're on. In fact, they thought we were too effective. So the churches preach in the pulpits, they in the classes and the studies, they need to move over to places where they preach in the cities, ministers of social programs fight against social ills in the streets. They move over. They want us to move over. So the guy politically says, I'm on the left. Why aren't my church always over on the right? Well, the church on the right is where they need to be. You need to move back where you were. So the fundamentalists, of course, want to avoid damaging social ills by preaching the gospel and sanctification, which they do, which is acknowledged by Henry. He even said that. But it is getting involved on the other side. Remember the little diagram up there? By getting involved in on the other side or on the other side is a mistake. On the outside or the other side is a mistake. He wants the church to move into the marketplace. Staying at home in the church is ineffective. Will not win America, not all go to church, I suppose you might say. But doesn't realize the powerness of the church, the pulpit that's preaching there every week after week after week. He even suggests limiting the size of building programs, in effect weakening the home place by funding ministries that serve the outsides. Spent money, by the way, is not a good measure of any effectiveness. The problem with the modernists is not that fundamentalists are hunkered down in the churches, is that the modernists reject the fundamentalist message wherever it is found. Showing social compassion outside does not change the modernist's heart nor his will. The fundamentalists remain the enemy of the modernists in or outside of their churches. So Henry recognizes this, but makes the mistake that if the gospel message is rejected, then perhaps the heart could be softened somehow by social caring and compassion. That will prepare the seedbed for the gospel, he thinks. He needs a short lesson in the fallenness of man, and Calvinism would eliminate that speculation. So it fails on all counts. Theologically, outside of the gospel, the saving of souls, fundamentalists have no more redemptive power than a lamppost. As per Henry's suggestion, fundamentalists cannot make the heart receptive. No social expression changes the heart. Economically, to help all the social ills will take money. More money than churches, municipalities, entire governments have. It is a waste of money. No real effect. To defer the efforts of the church away from its calling to the real red herring, chasing these social ills, evils. Well, Henry says, the day will now come for evangelicalism to think the whole building program. By tremendous outlay of funds, most church communities provide a worship structure which usually stands idle except for two Sunday services and a midweek prayer meeting, if that later. No secular steward could be happy about such a minimal use of facilities, representing so disproportionate an investment. Out of the modern crisis may come a better stewardship. He's attacking churches building their buildings for them to be housed in. They should take the money and do something else with it out there in the marketplace. So it's hard to think of a social need that can be met by a church organization. By the way, you ever have a small group, you don't know what else to do, you can make this as a project. Think of something that the church could do. And then follow it through. So just for discussion's sake, just for a moment here, let's pick the need for transportation. We at In Hill decide to help people get cars because they got to go to work, got to go to the hospital, got to get doctors, you know, go see grandma, whatever you do. So we buy cars, use ones. Then I said, well, why not new ones? Store them on our lot, fix them in our newly built garages for them to fix. In fact, you'll have a job. Give them away free to people who need them. How many people will be involved in the process of the cars, and the request to make a judgment about those not very needy and fix the cars that break down, to buy insurance, get the gas into them, and to buy the legal stuff, whatever, make them run. You know, I'm getting tired. Our church could not afford to provide all the cars needed in this city, or even a part of it. And we're just talking about cars, just one thing, one little thing. It is hard to draw the line between the needy and the greedy, right? So we'd have fights in the parking lot, and our security guys would come out. Think of the administration and legal entanglements. You know, a car broke down, you had a wreck, and somebody got hurt. We may, in our wildest dreams, be successful with this project, but there are scores of other needs that have not even been touched. We're talking about one little thing. Nor are there enough churches in our city to meet all the social needs of that city that all the city presents. Rather, all the people must depend on self-interest and the producing economy in freedom of free markets, secured private property, and a government providing a safe environment to grow family wealth. If that isn't the present, you can't afford the rest. The church can teach the morals of Christianity in line with what it does as a church gathered. That's true, and we do it all the time. But the standard for modernist success in solving social ills is, well, at least they tried. Don't matter, they didn't do anything. All right, so at least they tried. That's what at least did one. Never mind the real value, the real cost, the real neglect of the gospel, or the real unintended consequences, which sometimes is dependence, not freedom. What is left is an uneasy good feeling for a very short time, if any. But no sustainable help is originally intended. Even those Jesus helped, remember, had to find their next meal on their own. Forcing the ethics and morality and social needs in society are diverting efforts away from the mandated church ministry, which is a soul-rescuing work. Social issues must be handled the right way, and there's probably different suggestions of how you would do this. I don't think we need scholars for it, by the way. What to do with teenage pregnancy, for example, will not be solved by the church dollars or even the time spent at clinics off-site, unless that clinic is tied somehow to the church's internal ministries and its broader programs. It will do no good, except maybe just a few. But to suggest from the pulpit that parents and school and culture ought to expect sexual abstinence is wrong and impossible. The moderns verbalize on the ground that to suggest sexual avoidance is insensitive to the plight of pregnant girls and their families, so they should keep their mouths shut, they say. See how this is on the wrong side again? So a quick look at government social program shows the failure of the high road assumed by the leftists. Look at the right. The lines as you go to the right, they get longer. That means more money is spent on poverty. And the blue line shows the percentage of people still in poverty. Doesn't relate, does it? Doesn't relate. And there's probably all kinds of charts. The truth is that fundamentalists do have a great impact on cultural health. They do. Fundamentalists teach that freedom of personal choice and personal responsibility and consequences for one's actions to build the orderly which is necessary to build an orderly, self-sufficient society. To accept the charge that fundamentalists have no social concerns is wrong. I got lots of social concerns. They're with you guys. The difference is that the fundamentalists have a lasting influence on their children and those who are taught biblically. And that's not perfect, but we're at least doing what we're supposed to do. For Henry, adopting New Orthodoxy and versions of covenantalism presents another problem for Henry and his ideas of Christ's mission. And this is where he keeps on using the word redemptive worker in all history. The New Orthodoxy's talk of redemption does not mean the soul, but primary meaning society. The society is going to be redeemed. So we're in redemptive business. Doesn't mean that we're saving souls. We're just somehow reclaiming lives from whatever. So how can fundamentalists cooperate with this kind of definition of redemption? Henry could talk about redemptive communism as better than unredemptive capitalism. What is that? In order for society to flourish, it must have the redemptive ingredient, he says. What's that? Again, neo-orthodoxy, bewilderment. We use words that we don't understand what they mean. So failing to compromise, this I could have left this off, but just kind of interesting because in the Matthew 28:15 passage, it says, go into all the world, preach the gospel. And sometimes that's misunderstood, even by the socialist people want to do social things. And it says, you know, sometimes we say, well, then the Lord can come when this is done. Well, I think that probably we misunderstand that passage. So I'm going to say, how are we to reach the whole world, each person, each country, and so forth, in each generation? How long can the world be reached and not fall back to unbeliever status again? So I think a misunderstanding of that passage. I think what the passage is saying is what you do every day is you go out as far as the world. There's no place that's off limits. Perhaps to go into the whole world is not the conquest of the world with the gospel or relieve the social ills, but speaks of the unrestricted extent of the gospel, and that's true for every generation. So finally, my brethren and sisters, we have the simple charge as a church body. A simple charge as a church body, as Paul wrote Timothy in his last letter, preach the word, be ready in season, out of season, you know, in character, out of character, wherever you are. Now the social aspect, rebuke, reprove, rebuke, exhort, with great patience and instruction. And we could pile a lot of other things on here, what they're supposed to do. So I ask you, is there not a social component in this text? Surely, reprove, rebuke, exhort with great patience and instructions are such instructions. And with that, I leave you and amen.